number of patterns.
The time is 9:45, so I will call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. We do not yet have a quorum, but we can begin with testimony. Representative Becker Finn, welcome to the committee. I'll figure out when we have a quorum, but so I won't move your bill just yet, but yes, if you could proceed with your testimony, that would be
great. Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill would create, it's pretty straightforward. It would create a Veteran Suicide Awareness Day, and I really want most of my time to be dedicated to my testifier, Alyssa Harrington, if it would be okay with the chair for her to go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Of course. My name is Alyssa Harrington. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I said, my name is Alyssa Harrington, and I'm here in support of House File 586 in order to declare a Veteran Suicide Awareness Day. It's important to do this because it's important we talk about the breadth and depth of veteran suicides. This bill is just a start. It is a way to start the conversation about something that is a public health, mental health, and trauma issue. I want to talk to you about my brother's 34th birthday. It was this past December, on December 14th. And on that day, I went and received a tattoo. The tattoo in the center is a compass rose, showing for a long time, sailors would have this tattooed on them to show their way home. It's surrounded by Celtic knotting, showing the everlasting love between my brother and I. And at the top it says, Le Toul du Nord, because at heart we were both Minnesotans. In the center is my brother Justin's tattoo. It's something he designed himself. And as I had it tattooed on my arm, I sat and spoke with a veteran about veterans' mental health issues, veteran suicide, and what it's like living with PTSD. That veteran was not my brother, Justin. Because my brother, Justin, is one of the 20-some veterans a day who committed suicide nearly a year, a little over a year ago now. Every time I bring up the stories of his suicide, I hear more. I hear people taking the invitation of me sharing to share their own stories. The brothers, the sisters, the wives, the husbands, the fathers, the brothers in arms who took their life after struggling with PTSD, depression, and other suicidal ideation. I also hear about the veterans who aren't counted in the 20-something-a-day number, those who die of overdoses, alcoholism, and other deaths of despair. And every time I hear these stories, I want to share a little bit more about Justin. So today I'm going to do that. Justin James Miller was born here in St. Paul. He's my little brother, 3 years younger, and always, always had a great sense of humor. He went to Forest Lake High School, as did I, where he played in the band. The picture I have of him today is of him playing the trumpet, one of his lifetime loves. This picture is of him playing the national anthem at an American Legion 4th of July event the year before he killed himself. That trumpet took him into the Marine Corps. He was so good that they had to make the scores different, lower them on his application so that he could go to basic training. So he decided if he was going into the Marine Corps, he was going to be a Marine. So we went into the Marine Corps as a trumpet player. He went through basic, and he went to his band, the band in Cherry Point, North Carolina. Something a lot of people don't know about the Marine Corps band is that they deploy with their unit. So even though my brother was a trumpet player and that was his primary operational duty, he had a secondary operational duty as base security. As base security, he deployed to Iraq, to Al Asad Airport, Air Base. When he was there, he guarded the troops. He would be in the towers with his, usually not with his trumpet and the gun, but only with the gun. And at night, he'd go play for the troops or for school groups in Iraq and try to bring a little bit of home to the desert. But when he was in that guard position, he was required to point his gun at the heads of people as they entered the base and wait for a dog to sit. If the dog sat, he had to shoot. He also had to shoot incoming camels, which might seem funny and strange to you, but the problem was is that those camels had riders. And sometimes those camels had explosives. And so he went there, and then he came home. And he was different. He was a little bit less funny, a little more prone to anger, a little more prone to taking things far too seriously. But we didn't know if that was everything or if that was just the tip of the iceberg. Because like many veterans, he didn't want to be a bother to anyone. He did not want to be a bother to my parents, to his friends, to his family, or to anyone else. He always wanted to help people and fix things, which is why when he returned to Minnesota, he followed my father into the IBEW, into the apprenticeship program for electricians, and was in his third year of apprenticeship, about to complete his fourth year, when he committed suicide last February. That week, he called the VA hotline for suicide, and they told him to go to the VA. My brother never left. Now, there's been plenty of ink spilled, some of it you have before you, about what went wrong at the VA. I'm not going to really re-examine that here. You have an article from the Washington Post. There is also an OIG investigation into my brother's death. What I want to talk about instead is why it is important we continue to talk about this and why it's important we have a day set aside to do just that. My tattoo is a physical reminder and representation of not only my grief, but also my connection to my brother. It's as if I have a string tied to my arm that goes to him. And I want you to think of every veteran, the 22 a day, those who are in grief, who are ODing, who are depressed, who have PTSD. I want you to imagine all the people who are rocking around with a similar string that ties them to their loved one, that brings this issue home. The thing is, those strings are invisible, and they're incredibly hard to talk about. There's a reason why, if I'm from a bartender to a hairdresser, to people that I meet after committee meetings like this, they come up to me and they talk about their loved one. Because it's still not okay to talk about suicide. It's still not okay to talk about what we put our veterans through, the trauma that causes, and how that leads to a public health, mental health, and trauma-induced problem. There are still so many taboos. And those taboos grow when you're talking about a soldier who was supposed to be able to police himself, a Marine, who could make sure that his collar stays were perfectly inserted in his uniform, but couldn't figure out how to get past the broken brain that he said that he had. I've worked in this building before. I worked here in constituent services. And I went on to get a master's in advocacy and political leadership and a JD. And what I know from that experience is that it's hard to make good policy unless you can openly and honestly talk about the problem. And right now, we're not talking. The reason I support this bill, first and foremost, is to set a line in the sand, a marker every year that we come back and check in and see how we're talking about it. Check in on the problem. Make sure that there's a focus on it. And make sure that we're trying to take care of our veterans and eventually others, people who suffer from suicidal ideation, first as a public health issue before they ever get to a crisis, that we're examining our protocols and what we need to do in that moment of crisis, and then that we're caring for veterans and their families and friends afterward when the unthinkable has happened. I can't bring back my brother. This Saturday will always be the anniversary of the day I buried him. But that doesn't mean that we can't stop others. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Harrington. We do now have a quorum, so I will move that House File 586 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing any. Is there any member discussion? Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beckerfin. I just want to let you know that I really appreciate that you're bringing this forward. I'm on the Central Minnesota Mental Health Center Board, and obviously it's one of the things we talk about a lot is suicide. And one of the reasons I agreed to go onto the board is that last summer, not even last summer, we were still here in session, we had a veteran who had gone to the VA. He was told he had to go to the hospital emergency room in St. Cloud. The Mississippi River is right there. He walked out of the emergency room and walked in the river. I was so angry at how that could happen. And I talked to the police chief from Wake Park, Chief Bentrude, and I had expressed my anger in a meeting, and he said, I'll tell you how it happened. And they had how many touches this guy had before he walked in the Mississippi, and we're not connecting dots, and we're not allowing sharing of information. I realize information is private, but this is one of the things, this is one of the reasons why we don't have a solution, is we're so busy protecting data that we're not connecting dots when we should be connecting dots with the people who could save the lives. So thank you for doing this. I really appreciate your story. This past Monday at 11:30, I did have Laura Kunstelben from the St. Cloud VA here, and she had some suicide prevention training. She is absolutely willing to do it at any time. Again, she travels around and does this at VAs, at Legions, at different VAs, VFWs, you name it. And anytime we want to have her come back again, it was a really nice presentation. We can do that so that we can be better armed in how we need to stop this from happening and not be so wishy-washy about, you know, it's kind of a sensitive thing to talk about. Thank you. And I'm really sorry for your loss.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that there are a lot of activities that veterans organizations across the state, both local and regional, et cetera. Is there going to be, combining of, the choice of the date and et cetera, if you can let us know how that works in with, that cooperative efforts who have a broader activity than just having a day on the calendar?
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we mentioned, this is kind of seen as a starting point. Our first stop for I serve on the Veterans Affairs Committee, and so our first stop was in that committee. There was a lot of support there, and certainly the intention would be that it isn't just a day that's written on a calendar somewhere, but it's a meaningful day where we can draw attention to the issue and bring people to the table. So that's certainly the intention, assuming that the bill passes and we can move forward.
Okay. Representative Quam?
No, I just wanted it brought out
sure.
publicly that this is just not, oh, we're doing a day, mm-hmm. we're doing this. No, that there's a broader impact that this is coordinated with.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank the representative for bringing this forward. Last Friday, we had a transportation meeting in St. Cloud, and afterwards I went up to talk to some women that were in the audience. And the last woman was a former VA nurse. I think she was 89 years old. And she kept, you know, her big deal is we are not doing enough to help the veterans. I mean, she was in tears. And I know that there's, I do know that there is a lot going on, but obviously it's not enough. So again, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Becker-Finn, and thank you for, I serve on the Veterans Committee along with Representative Becker-Finn, and I just wanted to thank her for taking the time with me in your office a couple days later to talk more in depth about this issue. And just as a fellow Marine, one question for Ms. Harrington. What was the years that your brother was in Iraq? I also served in Iraq.
Ms. Harrington.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Heinrich. My brother deployed in 2005. So was there from 2005 to 2006.
Yeah. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, to tell Marine Corps saying means always faithful, semper fidelis to you, Ms. Harrington.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Are there any additional member questions or comments? Okay, Representative Becker-Finn, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really want the focus to be on the words of my testifier. I think she said more than I could ever say about this issue. So thank you very much.
Thank you both. I'll renew my motion that House File 586 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you both. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 505, Representative Fisher's bill. I understand they have some setup to do while they are doing that. I would look for approval of the minutes of the February 26th, 2019 meeting.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the approval.
Okay, Representative Elkins moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. So I will move that House File 505 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Fisher, when you are ready, you may proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 505 to you about creating a task force to redo the state flag. This is an issue that came to me back in October 2017 when I had a couple of high school students who are with me here today reach out to me with a request to re-examine our state flag. I was very impressed by the presentation. They included quite a bit of information to me, going into a little bit about the history, some other efforts that have happened in the past on the state flag, and so I'm going to let them talk about that in their presentation, but there's a couple of things I wanted people to be aware of as we take a look at the state flag. Is the state flag in a lot of ways is a symbol of our brand here in the state of Minnesota. And when you take a look at most companies, one of the fiercest things that they protect, one of the number one things they focus on is their brand image. And an example I'll use is Target. You know, everyone sees that red bullseye out there, and we all know we're talking about Target. Our state brand, our state flag is one that is really kind of bland and doesn't stand out. Kids aren't able to draw it. People aren't able to remember it. Examples might be the Colorado state flag. People remember that, and you see it all over the place. And so what we're looking at is an opportunity to help rebrand our state, help as part of an effort that will people be able to remember that, people take pride in their state flag and be able to put it out there. The two young gentlemen I have with me today, have done a great job in terms of presentation. They've been featured on Almanac at the Capitol. There was a presentation that was done on them on March 28th of last year. And then on March 30th, they were also featured on the Almanac wrap that was done. I did not include those presentations today because I know we have limited time, but I do have links, and I will send that out to the committee. So if you'd like more opportunities to see the presentations, it's something that I've been very impressed with, and others have been impressed with their presentation. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to these two young gentlemen here, Jack Kleckman and Thomas Atkins, and they are doing a joint presentation that we're still, I see, getting pulled up here. And I realize the basement is not the best room for audio or for technical presentations. So,
sure. So, would you, if you could please just state your name, whoever's going first, to state your name for the record to start with?
Jack Hulkman.
Sorry, what was your last name?
Hulkman.
Hulkman, okay. Thank you for being here, Mr. Hulkman. Do you need the presentation to be ready? Well, oh, it looks like it's up there, actually. So, I think if you could proceed with your testimony.
Good design, whether it be a logo, architecture, or a flag, often captures our interest, and when done correctly, can be an instantly recognizable symbol of a concept or place. Citizens in a region with a well-designed flag often feel proud to be under the flag and what it represents. For example, Chicago's flag is the platonic ideal of a flag that inspires citizen pride. The flag is very well designed, with two blue stripes representing the two rivers, and four red stars representing four major historical events in Chicago's history: Fort Dearborn, the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, World's Columbian Exposition, the Century of Progress Exposition 1933-34. Chicago's flag's success is measured by its omnipresence. It is seen both flying from buildings and on souvenir merchandise. The citizens of Chicago clearly take great pride in their flag. And in Chicago, when a police officer passes, the Chicago flag, rather than the American flag, may be draped over the casket because of how much Chicagoans love and respect not only their city, but also their flag. Reverence and respect for a flag is strongly correlated with good design. So in order to understand why some flags are seen more frequently than others, we turn to NAVAS, or the National American Vexillological Association, five principles of flag design. These principles were compiled by Ted Kai, a vexillologist, someone who studies flags. By observing patterns in flags that were flown with pride by citizens compared to flags that were all but unknown just because of disuse. The first guideline is arguably the most important when evaluating designs. Keep it simple. Simple enough that a child could draw it from memory. Simple shapes and patterns allow a flag to be recreated and recognized easily, which are both very important for a flag. Furthermore, simpler shapes also lead to a smaller cost of production. While using simple shapes, one must also use meaningful symbolism to illustrate what a flag stands for. It should be something that's widely recognizable by citizens and can be clearly understood from an outside perspective. The symbolism should represent common cultural elements and resonate with the people it represents. The colors on the flag should also be kept as simple as possible. Using 2 to 3, at the very most, 4 colors ensures a flag is not too busy with its color scheme. A good flag should also not have to literally spell out what it represents, so flags should not have any sort of lettering or seals on it. Writing what you are trying to represent on a flag ruins the whole point of having a symbolic flag. Furthermore, seals are meant for close viewing, so small details can be distinguished, but on a flag that's potentially flying 200 feet away, small details run together and can't be identified. A seal and flag are meant for different purposes, so they should stay separate entities. The final principle is to be distinct or be related. A flag design can use similar elements as other flags to show similarity and connection, but the design should avoid being so similar that it begins to become difficult to distinguish from each other.
Thank you, Mr. Kalkman. Mr. Atkins, if you could just start with your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Thomas Atkins. I would like to thank the committee for letting us state our position on this issue. The Minnesota flag, fails every single point on this list. For reference, here's the state flag flying in St. Paul. The design is not simple. The flag must be screen printed rather than sewn, increasing the cost of production, and no child could draw it from memory. In fact, the flag is so complicated, you probably didn't recognize that in this picture, the flag is flying upside down. Flag fails the second guideline, use meaningful symbolism, because while there are many symbols on the flag, they are so cluttered in the steel that the symbolism is hard to distinguish and lost on many. Ask a Minnesotan what their flag symbolizes and many won't know. The violations of points 3 and 4 are obvious. The flag uses 7 colors rather than 2 or 3, and the word Minnesota is written on the flag in the state seal. Finally, point 5's instruction is to be distinct or be related. In this image of 20 state flags, can you tell which is Minnesota's? Mm-hmm. Even if you can, others not residing in our great state may not be able to. The flag fails to be distinct, but it's too related to other state flags to be easily distinguishable.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Okay, Mr. Kalkman.
In a 2001 state provincial flag survey, NAVA hosted a poll on their website asking its members and the public about flag designs in the U.S. and Canada. It lasted around 3 months and intended to discover which states and provinces had the best and worst flag designs. Around 100 NAVA members and 300 members of the public cast around 29,000 votes by the end of the survey. Flags were rated on a scale of 1 to 10, and every flag with a seal or intricate design on the blue background, dubbed a seal on a bedsheet, ended with a score of 5 or lower, with dear old Minnesota falling in rank 67 out of 72, with a score of 3.13. The large mass of seals on blue backgrounds makes recognizing any of them extremely difficult to an untrained eye. Ted Kai of NAVA states, one doesn't need to be a flag expert to know good flag design. So foregoing the principles of flag design typically leads to less popularity. One only infrequently sees the Minnesota flag flying prominently outside of government buildings. In fact, when you Google Minnesota flag t-shirt, the fourth image is a t-shirt with the outline of Minnesota, but Colorado's flag instead. Another state flag has literally taken the place of ours, and it's not a coincidence that the flag of Colorado follows all of NAVA's guidelines. Well-designed flags are more popular. However, Minnesota's flag does not catch the eye or retain a viewer's gaze, nor hold a place in the citizens' hearts. Popularity is the ultimate measure of a good flag. So the lack of public support for our flag seals its fate. Minnesota does not have a good flag.
Mr. Atkins.
To address our complicated mess of a flag, we are asking you to further the progress of House File 505. This bill would not change the flag directly, but rather set up a task force to study design changes. So by passing this bill, you are not committing to a state flag, merely deciding to look into the issue. Furthermore, the bill would allow task force members to solicit voluntary service and aid of vexillologists and other persons who have either technical or artistic skill in flag construction and design. A method that other regions have used to solicit aid is an online competition through which members of the public could submit and vote for designs, which would both encourage civic participation and connection to the state flag. The potential system would place the burden of design and selection on the public, so committee members would not need to take time away from more pressing issues. A number of individuals have already been creating new vexillologically sound flag designs, some of which are shown here. Many emphasize Minnesota's natural beauty and identity as the North Star State, much more revealing of our true nature than a seal on a blue background. For those of you worried about the economic cost of a new flag, this could potentially be offset by the additional merchandising and tourism revenue that a new flag would bring. Furthermore, the cost of production of a well-designed flag would be lower, as well-designed flags are simpler and often can be sewn, not screen printed. While a short-term cost may be incurred, the flag might pay for itself in the long run. Let's consider the purpose of a flag. A proper flag is a recognizable symbol of a region, flown with pride by its citizens. We Minnesotans have pride in our state, and deservedly so. We have a top-ranked public university. Our natural beauty rivals that of any other state. We are stereotyped for being too nice. We're the star of the North, Le Toit du Nord. We have much to be proud of. And we all deserve to be able to express our state pride by flying a well-designed flag. Therefore, we are respectfully asking this committee to advance the progress of House File 505 in order to get Minnesotans the flag we all deserve. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you both for your testimony. Okay. Representative Kwong?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can staff remind us when the existing Minnesota flag was first flown?
I don't know if, well, I'm happy to ask staff. I don't know that that's part of his regular job duties, knowing that, but let's see if you know that.
I'm sure of some problem. Actually, I do know that.
Oh, okay, wonderful. Sorry, I doubted you, Mr. Gehring.
So, Mr. Sheriff, some quam, it's in the bill summary. The current design of the state flag was adopted in 1957. The last change was in 1983, just to update the state seal, which was also updated at that time. And then prior to 1957, the state flag actually was similar in design, but a little bit more ornate and had a blue front and a white back. So it was a little bit more distinctive in that way, but that flag hasn't existed in the state since 1957.
Representative Kwong?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted people to understand, you know, sort of the history of this type of process in the state. And, you know, when I was seeing this demonstration, remind me with a Fun with Flags episode. Yes. I think the youth of would understand that. But thank you for bringing, you know, coming before us and testifying.
Thank you, Representative Kwong. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony and what you gentlemen are doing. And thank you to the author. But I want to speak in support of our flag, since I feel like our flag doesn't have a voice to speak for itself. And so I thought I would take this opportunity to just kind of voice my concern about a design that might be actually too simple. We are uniquely sophisticated here in Minnesota, and I like the regal and sophisticated flag, and I think it represents the people of Minnesota well. Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fisher. I was inclined to support the bill up until I saw who you want to put on the task force. Three members of the Senate and three members of the House. We'll screw it up. I think your testifiers talked about having some spots for some actual experts in the field. And as I see it, the bill establishing the legislative task force wouldn't accomplish what your testifiers are recommending.
Representative Fisher, do you have a response?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Saras, thank you for the input. What I did is I took what we had as legislation in the past, and I'm very open to input that people have in modifying, and I expect that this will change by the time it gets to the next stop. And I would welcome anyone who'd like to be involved in offering ideas for it. I know some people have mentioned it should at least be, if we've got legislators on it, should at least be bipartisan, and then incorporating other people. But this is part of what I wanted to hear from the committee today, is what they felt was maybe an ideal size, and some of the people that we wanted to make sure that we have on it, so that when I do the next amendment, that I can incorporate these kind of recommendations.
Representative Fisher, I notice it does also say in line 1.12 that the task force, it's not required, maybe it should be, but it does say that the task force may solicit and secure the voluntary service and aid of vexillologists and other persons who have either technical or artistic skill in flag construction and design. And Representative Zerwas, just to get to your concern, I promise you that I will take myself out of the running to be on this commission. I have red-green color blindness, and you do not want me on this commission. Representative Zerwas.
He wants to be
on. I feel much better now. I think, Representative Fisher, to your point, it would probably, rather than three from each body, it should probably be four from each body, get to a Republican and a Democrat from each body. And then I don't know what the interest level would be from the executive branch, but obviously the state flag travels around the country with the governor, and I would imagine the executive branch would have some input in any design or redesign as well. And to the students that came today to testify, thank you very much for your presentation.
All right. I don't have any other. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an additional comment. I believe it was a comment made on Sovereignty Day, but I've heard it before, is that maybe the problem is not so much with the flag as with the state seal, and the state seal probably needs to be looked at as well, because I know it is offensive to some people in our state.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Are there additional comments from members or questions? I just want to draw members' attention to Representative Pawlowski, who's on this committee, is not able to be here today, but he has done some work on this issue in the past, so I made sure that his materials were handed out to all members. Representative Fisher has a copy and can incorporate those as well. I do want to mention, too, just as the representative of District 45B, the city of Crystal, a couple years ago, went through a process of creating a city flag. I think it won a national award because it's very, it meets many of those criteria that your students ably described, and it's not overly complicated. So, you know, if the task force wants to consider that, I think that's a good example of a local one. But Representative Fisher, do you have any closing remarks?
I want to say thank you for the opportunity to present. I'd like to thank my testifiers. I hope that you were as impressed with their presentation as I was, and you can probably see why I was getting on board after meeting with them on it. They are truly experts in what they do, and for me, I'm just really impressed with our young generation coming up and looking forward to their involvement as they get older in the future. And I ask for your support to move this on to the next process. And for those that are interested with their continued input as to how the task force would look, I look forward to working with you on it, getting it revised for the next stop. Thank you.
Thank you for your willingness to consider suggestions, Representative Fisher. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 505 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Thank you, Representative Fisher.
Thank you.
Representative Schultz. While Representative Schultz is coming down here, I will move that House File 1216 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And I understand you also have an author's amendment, Representative Schultz.
We do have an author's amendment.
Okay. I will move the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape Representative Schultz would like it. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you like. Representative Schultz, please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank you for taking the time to hear House File 1216 today. The City of Duluth, Essentia Health, and St. Luke's Hospital have been working together on the largest economic redevelopment opportunity in the city's history. Essentia Health is investing over $800 million in a new hospital and ancillary medical facilities. St. Luke's is also investing upwards of $200 million in new and updated facilities on their campus. These substantial private investments will change the face of the East Hillside in Duluth, providing opportunities for investment in housing and commercial ventures on land that is currently used for surface parking or occupied by old, outdated buildings. House File 1216 looks to leverage these historic private investments to obtain public infrastructure funding from the state to take advantage of this rare redevelopment opportunity. I have with me today Mayor Emily Larson to talk more about the bill and opportunities it would create for Duluth and Northeast Minnesota. And she'll specifically talk about the advisory board, which is the relevant piece of this bill for this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Welcome to the committee. Mayor Larson, if you could just please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me. Thank you, Representative Schultz. My name is Emily Larson. Good morning. I am the mayor for the city of Duluth. So, Chair Freiberg, thank you for hearing House File 1216, a bill we are extremely excited about in Duluth. As Representative Schultz explained, this is an economic development bill that seeks state funding for public infrastructure to help modernize and revitalize our East Hillside neighborhood. And while I am happy to answer any questions in general about the bill, I do understand that this committee is specifically interested in the advisory board that will be created as a result of this legislation. The advisory board will be responsible for creating a development plan for the newly formed medical district. The public purpose of the district is to repurpose and redevelop vacant and underutilized land, to incentivize and continue to grow private investment, to increase tax generation and job creating opportunities. The area currently has numerous surface parking lots and old dilapidated housing which have not been redeveloped or updated in years. We are eager and hopeful about the housing opportunities that will result from this newly created district. So with that little bit of background, I'd like to talk a bit about the advisory board that will develop an overall development plan for the medical district. The board will consist of 9 members: the mayor, 1 city council member, 2 representatives of Essentia Health, 1 representative from St. Luke's, 1 member of the Duluth Greater Downtown Council, 1 representative of the Local Building and Trades Council, and 2 representatives appointed by the governor, one of which must have expertise in housing policy and finance. The board will prepare a development plan for the medical district, which will then need to be approved by the Duluth City Council. The board will propose modifications to the plan, also subject to City Council approval. The board will be responsible for creating and submitting a report to the Deed Commissioner and Jobs Committee chairs in both the House and Senate by January 31st of each year, with a copy of the development plan, any changes to the plan, a progress report of projects identified in the plan, as well as actual costs and financing sources. Costs of the advisory board will be incurred by the city, which is one of the ways we are partnering with the state in this economic development opportunity. A few additional points of interest with the project. Project labor agreements will be required by the city, and there are specific hiring targets that we are working towards. The city will, as I said, provide space and staff for the advisory board. This is a level of investment not yet seen in Duluth, and we are doing all that we can to take advantage of this once-in-a-generation redevelopment opportunity. And in terms of the public infrastructure, we are making a deliberate commitment to affordable housing within this district, and this investment does build upon the bonding support we have received from the state of Minnesota for our district energy and our closed-loop hot water system by extending that system to both hospitals. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to describe the importance of this project. I am happy to stand and answer any questions you may have. We also do have representatives from St. Luke's and from Essentia Health who are here and can answer questions that you may have about their private investment or their construction plans. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mayor Larson. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, not seeing any, I will stand for member questions. Representative Sauk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to offer a comment, and I hope that this is taken as an observation for the betterment of process and ideas. We've obviously had some experience in this kind of thing, and I've sat not on a commission, not as an elected member, not as a person that was up here when the big decisions were made. This is purely an outsider relative to, but of high interest in our community. And one thing about the makeup of the board that functions in our project that I think has been significant, and I've noticed it, and that is people from outside that genuinely have a different perspective on what's going on rather than the local expertise. there are about half and half. And so I only offer that as a thing that I suspect you considered. I suspect it was thought about as to who or how we should name them. But I can tell you the value of somebody who is disconnected in this set of decisions, because you really are going to be stepping outside of the normal business culture of your city, and you're going to need to have or benefit from very outside experience. And so I would only offer it as something to consider. I have no intention that it should ever be, you know, a demand or an expectation to the thing. Just, I think it's worth considering. Thank you.
Representative Schultz, any comments?
Yes,
or
Mr. Chair. Response? So I believe, and the mayor can add to this, but the plans will be reviewed in public and have public comment. Do you want to speak to that?
Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Thank you, Representative Sauk. Yes, that is true, and we will have those appointees by the governor, which we would anticipate would have statewide and likely out of our community representation and voice and input. I also just want to share with you that we are doing our best to bring the learnings of the DMC into this and intentionally doing some things that are really making it specific for Duluth. Both in things that have worked well for Rochester and the community and things that we need to see go differently just for us. So thank you for your input. That's really valuable. We will actually be, I believe it's April 1st, we will be in Rochester to meet with the team there and continue to do to glean their learnings. So your comments are really valuable. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Sticking with the Rochester theme, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as was mentioned, the something in regards to the open and transparency. I'm just curious, why then are you not providing the 60-day, or you're exempting from the 60-day rule for review and approval of development plans?
Mayor Larson.
Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative Quam. So what we propose to do, and I'm not sure which specific area in the bill you're speaking of, if it is as it relates to the development plan coming before council or if it relates to the development plan coming before the board. But we have those two mechanisms in there in place specifically. Naturally, there is going to be some time frame that has to take. The Duluth City Council meets twice per month. And then we have public notification ahead of time. So in terms of start to finish, while there will be maybe no requirement for a 60-day, it does not get expedited, you know, significantly fast. We move at the speed of a local government, but we do move at the speed of a government, so there is that openness and transparency. Not sure if I'm fully answering your question, Representative.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I stopped counting at 10 for the exemptions allowed the city from normal regulations, whether it's TIF, whether it's you know, etc. But having been on this committee several terms, I do know that you know, such things as you know, transparency, meeting, and other guidelines, any changes that go through here and as part of the domain of this committee, and you know, specifically exempting. I'm not saying that there's not the intent to follow. What I'm saying is it's not trivial for this committee to say there's not the requirement to behave like other governmental entities in transparency and openness. And that's why I was trying to understand why there was such an urgent need to be relieved of following other, you know, guidelines and regulations that any other city in the state would be required to do.
Mayor Larson.
If I may, Chair. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative. So we are open to your feedback, and certainly Representative Schultz is the one who is the conduit for us here. We do have developments and private development that is actively happening. It is starting. It is taking off. So there are some adjustments that we seek and we would like support of. But we are certainly open to the feedback that you want to provide us and guidance that would help us meet your requirements.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay.
Representative
Mr. Chair, can I just comment?
Representative Schultz.
So on page 15 or 15.29, we do follow a public hearing before approving any infrastructure project. We follow sections 469.53 and 469.54 of the code.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Schultz. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I look through this, a lot of time is spent in the bill talking about the appropriation bonds. It appears to me that there would be up to $164 million of appropriation bonds issued by the state to support this.
That's a financial question. I'm sure will be hashed out in ways and means. If you do have a quick response, Representative.
That's correct. $164 million, and I think that Schultz. Application is around $13 million.
Okay. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I knew I couldn't go into financial things. But, and if you just indulge me for one or two more questions, those appropriation bonds then are guaranteed by whom? The payments ultimately are guaranteed by whom?
Representative Schultz?
I believe it's the city. It's holding the risk.
Okay, Representative Vogel?
And that was my assumption as well, just wanted to clarify. So therefore, if we get into Section 8, and we look at the composition of this board, the advisory board, the appropriating agency will, or the appropriating body will be the legislature, because they're the only ones that can appropriate. And yet I see no representation there of the legislature. Was there consideration given to that?
Representative Schultz?
I believe early in discussion, when we brought this bill forward last session, we discussed the advisory board and had different permutations, and this is where we came to an agreement with both hospital systems.
Okay. Representative Vogel?
Well, Mr. Chair, as long as it is the purview of our committee to be looking at the structure of this, shouldn't we have, and this be a question to the author, shouldn't we have a majority of the members on the committee that would be appropriating up to $164 million of state debt that we are ultimately responsible for if things don't go right? Shouldn't there be a majority of the legislature on that committee to ensure the financial solvency of the state?
Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's a good point you raised. Let's talk offline about the structure of whether or not we should have legislators and elected officials on the board. And we're going to learn a lot from the Destination Medical Center and their board structure as well on April 1st.
Okay. Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes. Representative Heinrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, or maybe this question might be for Mayor Larson, but under Section 10, Subdivision 4, starting at line 15.3, there's a public bidding exemption. It says the city need not require competitive bidding with respect to a parking facility or other public improvements constructed in conjunction with, directly above or below or adjacent. My question is why is there an allowance to not have to use a public bidding process on the projects within the district?
Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for your question. This is specifically so that we can move projects forward quickly. It is not intended for any kind of lack of transparency. It is a cost efficiency. We have some projects that are already moving, and so what we are seeking is that these would go through the board development, it would go through the council, it would have that. The public bidding exemption is really just to allow us to infuse the projects with the project labor, with the trades, and in a timeline that can meet some of the projects that are already beginning as we speak. Essentia Health has moved forward with their financing, so they will be starting construction very soon. And we are already lining up projects and preparing ourselves to help meet the deadlines that they need to meet.
Representative Heinrich?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So the contractors, for the most part here, have already been chosen or already in the process of doing work?
Mayor Larson?
Chair, thank you. No, we are in the design process, and the contractors, there is a series of conversations happening. Essentia Health is moving forward with that. St. Luke's is moving forward with that. Contracts have not been secured. That has not been fully vetted yet. But the design is active, of course, because these projects take multiple years really to get through.
Representative Heinrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't know if maybe research can answer questions. This, being a little bit new here, is a public bidding exemption a normal thing for these types of projects?
Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heinrich, it does happen from on major projects, but how often, I'd have to look at that. And I was actually going to look into the Destination Medical Center to see if the enabling legislation for that also had an exemption from competitive bidding, and I can get back to you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't have any other members on the list. Representative Zerwas, you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was actually going to be my question, is mm-hmm. if that type of enabling legislation is allowed in the Destination Medical Center. Sounds like Ms. Dyson has mm-hmm. an answer, perhaps.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, representatives, in the enabling legislation for the Destination Medical Center, it does include a public bidding exemption that I find the... and it's pretty much the same as what's in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay. Any additional member discussion? Okay. Representative Schultz, any closing remarks?
I just want to thank members of the committee and Chair Freiberg for hearing this bill, and I appreciate your support going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1216, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion is adopted. Thank you for coming, Representative Schultz. I saw Richard. Oh, what's it? Okay, Representative Purcell, I think, is here. Thank you for your patience, Representative Purcell. You're very punctual.
Thank you for
having me. Yes. So I will move that House File 525 be recommended to pass and refer to the Ways and Means Committee. I understand you also have an author's amendment, Representative Purcell.
I do have an author's I have an amendment. And,
Yes. I have a note that Representative Zerwas would like to offer that amendment.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I'll actually move, since Representative Purcell isn't on the committee, I'll move the A1 amendment to allow the addition on the board.
Okay, thank you. Representative Zerwas moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like it, Representative Purcell, if you'd like to introduce your bill.
I'll do that. Thank you. And thank you, committee members. House File 525, and this, some of you have been here for a while, it might sound like a broken record because we've been doing this for a few years, for school districts, several of them around the state, and have to be the Bemidji School District is one. And Forest Lake School District is another. And Representative Bob Detmer is often sitting up here with me as he represents the Forest Lake area. So what we're endeavoring to do is to bring transportation equity to several school districts around the state. And what that means is that the formula, the way it's set up for school pupil transportation in Minnesota, it leaves some districts on the short end of it, and they don't have enough money from their transportation funding to transport pupils. So they're using classroom money to transport pupils, and we'd like to get that funding back in the classroom. So that's what this bill is intended to do. And I have several testifiers here this morning, Mr. Chair, and I would like to open that up for testimony to our superintendent on my right, Lutz from Bemidji, and Superintendent Massey from Forest Lake. So if you would indulge their testimony, please.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Massey. I'm superintendent for Forest Lake Area Schools and members of the committee. Thank you for your time. First of all, thank you to Representative Purcell and also our representative, Bob Detmer, for being a real champion of this issue over the number of years. Forest Lake Area Schools is a district, as you know, just 25 miles north of St. Paul, Minneapolis. Our district is approximately 220 square miles with an enrollment of 6,100 students. Transportation funding, as you are aware, is based on student enrollment, not the miles a district must drive to transport students. Consequently, districts with a large geography and dispersed housing, like Forest Lake, Bemidji, and some 90 other districts, must offset their transportation costs from the general fund. Specifically, Forest Lake Area Schools draws approximately $500,000 from the general fund every year to cover the transportation deficit. This issue is an issue of equity. $500,000 in the case for Forest Lake is approximately 10 teachers or other services that we could be providing in the classroom for students across our district. Specifically, we're asking for two things in this bill. First, to raise the dollar amount currently identified in statute to cover the deficit. And germane to this committee, the second part of our bill is to form a comprehensive task force to study this issue and identify a permanent fix to this issue. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Superintendent Massey. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Freiberg. My name is Tim Lutz. I'm the superintendent of the Bemidji Area School District. And since Superintendent Massey articulated the situation and our concerns very well, I would just like to be very brief, take only about a minute to highlight and paint a picture for you about what Bemidji Area Schools is going through in this same situation. The Bemidji Area Schools, which is roughly 230 miles north of here, is a district of 5,200 students. Our district is approximately 825 square miles. Our longest bus run is 46 miles one way. And that adds up to a lot of miles over the course of 173 student days. Bemidji's ridership of students is very high, with over 4,400 students in the morning, 4,800 in the evenings. Specifically, Bemidji School District draws about $560,000 away from the classrooms from its general fund in order to subsidize our transportation loss every single year. And so in our case, that is also another 10 or 11 teachers or very important support staff individuals who we need in the classroom. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you for being here, Superintendent Lutz. Thank you for coming all the way down. I really appreciate it. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I have a question from Representative Selk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In high school, I took algebra. My algebra teacher taught me that almost anything can be reduced to an equation that will then predict and or tell you what the answer is going to be. Is there an equation that predicts and or generally would tell you what the margin of the differential would be, so that it might be just a calculation that is done even every year to warrant X amount of dollars to be contributed because of a differential that is a product of an equation?
Superintendent Massey.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think the difficulty with the transportation sparsity is it's driven by student enrollment, not miles driven. So the calculus really is related to the miles a district must drive and the compensation for those miles.
Representative Selk?
I understood your answer. I am somehow haunted by that algebra teacher that banged into me over and over and over that, you know, if you figure it out, there is an equation that will predict something that's experienced across a number of other people.
Representative Purcell. I'm really wanting to jump in here. I had a similar algebra teacher. Let me just tell you that the algorithm that is in that we're using now doesn't work. That's the best way I could say it. There is an algorithm, but it doesn't work for districts that have high mileage for transportation.
Superintendent Lutz, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Chairman Freiberg. I think that you are right, and I think that what we're pointing out is that it's the variable that we need to change, and that's what we're looking at within that equation, and the variable is student head, student ridership, as opposed to the way it is situated now in the equation.
Representative Salk.
You just added a word that triggered it, because I agree that you can't predict student choices as to who will ride and who won't ride, even though you know where they live and you know that they would be possible riders. And so sometimes you get demanded to provide a service that nobody is using. And are those the vagaries that are haunting the calculation?
Representative Superintendent Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I would say that by and large, if I had our supervisor of transportation here, they do a pretty tight analysis on ridership, basing that from 1 year to the next, and there are adjustments made throughout the year when transportation is identified and therefore provided for a student or family that elect not at some point in the year to take advantage of that transportation. The routes are adjusted to accommodate that along the way. I don't know if this specifically, Mr. Chair, if I can add, I'm not sure that this specifically gets to your point. We believe from calculations from the Minnesota Department of Education that the, I guess the answer to the algebra question is a figure in the $30 to $34 million range for the 90-some districts that are incurring a deficit. So as we change the formula to miles, it really is a $30 to $34 million deficit. Yep.
Representative Salk.
And I just don't want to be misunderstood. I'm completely aware of the fact that these things exist, and I'm strongly in favor of adjusting so that the experience of classroom teaching and or providing the cognitive part of the work isn't invaded by the physical issues of getting the kids to school. I absolutely am supportive of it. I still am haunted by, you know, that somebody taught me that you can figure this out, but I understand that there can be factors that you can't control for, so I'll let it go.
Okay. Representative Elkins.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My very first public service position of any kind was as a member of the Bloomington School District's Transportation Task Force, where I learned that most school districts actually use automated scheduling and routing software. And the equation that you're looking for, and this is would be a Googleable term, but the general problem is referred to as the traveling salesman problem, because you're trying to figure out for a salesman who has to visit, you know, a number of destinations, what is the most efficient route that person can take that will hit all of the spots that need to be hit. And that kind of an algorithm is at the core of school bus scheduling and routings. And I would think that most school districts are using that kind of a software right now. So it might, one way of approaching this might be is to, you know, run the same algorithm for a number of school districts of different sizes and densities and see if the algebra equation emerges from that analysis.
Any comment? You don't have to.
Mr. Superintendent Chair, I would add this piece that for Bemidji as well as Forest Lake, we limit ridership to an hour. Sometimes that gets pushed to an hour and five, hour and 10. That's way too long for students to be on the bus in the morning and in the afternoon. So part of that equation is the length of time we want kids riding.
Yep.
We could cover transportation with the dollars we receive today if we didn't care how long kids were on the bus, but we need to factor that in as well.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in regards to the last two members of the committee's questions, House File 242, the microtransit one, a side effect of that is developing, because FedEx has software, they plug in the pickups, the drop-offs, and it calculates the most fuel-efficient, most time you know, efficient way of doing it, and the intent of that bill would be to be able to do that for, you know, local and other transit. So you're running full buses, you're running efficiently in that, and, you know, maybe we can look at doing something that would leverage statewide to assist with some of the busing to make it more efficient. But this bill really is to address the fact that we have a history, we have a current, and we're probably going to have a future where districts that are very rural or have a lot of area to cover just plain don't get sufficient reimbursement to handle transportation of children, which frankly I think should be a somewhat of a priority. And so I support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I don't have any other member comments or questions. Okay, seeing none, Representative Purcell, any closing remarks?
Just appreciate your support for the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your support. Thank your comments. I will renew my motion that House File 525, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of the Committee.
Representative Richardson. Thank you for your patience. So you have House File 987, and I will move that House File 987 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Oh, and it looks like there are treats. You did not need to do that, but we certainly appreciate it. If you could please present your bill, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 987 would expand access to driver education courses for low-income students across the state. The bill would also create a driver education work study group to study driver education availability and recommend changes to increase access to driver education courses. Once upon a time, a driver's education course were available to any student who wanted to participate. This was a time when taking driver's ed was a given, was considered a rite of passage, as teens were often trained as part of the public school curriculum. Today, the burden for funding driver's education falls onto families, and it's more readily available to those with a disposable income who can afford to pay for the training. When considering a driver's ed course can cost around $400, the teens that are most likely to be left out are the teens that are poor. With approximately 32% of children in Minnesota living in low-income families and many families living paycheck to paycheck, there are real barriers to low-income students participating in driver's education. A national survey conducted by the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety found that 20 years ago, two-thirds of teens received their licenses by age 18. Today, that number is closer to about half of teens receiving their license by 18. We're seeing more teens delaying in getting their licenses after 18 when states no longer require safety training for new drivers. According to the study, the most common reason teens delay getting their license, it was not having a car was the first reason, and closely behind that were cost factors. For transition age youth, what happens during these formative years can have long-ranging implications and impacts. Obtaining a driver's license is not just about fitting in or the stigma that can occur when you're left out, but it's also about the practical realities of access. This includes access to vital classroom and behind-the-wheel safety instruction training, and it's also about economics and critically important access to educational, employment, and housing opportunities. Not having a driver's license can be a major barrier to employment. Studies have shown that a driver's license can be a better predictor of someone's ability to transition to a full-time job, more so than even a high school diploma. We spend a lot of time talking about and analyzing the achievement gap and the opportunity gap in our schools. Access to driver's ed can also contribute to that gap. We're seeing predictable disparities on racial and economic lines when it comes to driver's license attainment. According to that AAA study that I referenced, 67% of white teens obtain their license by age 18, compared to 37% of black teens and 29% of Hispanic teens. Also, only 25% of teens living in households with incomes of less than $20,000 a year obtained their licenses by 18. while 79% of teens and households of incomes of over $100,000 obtained their license by 18. As we continue to work to address existing inequities, one part of that strategy is to craft policies that make driver's education more accessible for students. And with that, I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Did you have any testifiers for your bill?
No, I don't have any testifiers for the bill. And I do have a letter from the Minnesota Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage that I can send around as well that they have sent in support.
Sure, if you could give that to the page, that page Emily, that would be great. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on House File 987? Mr. Heller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent 26 exceptional people with print disabilities. Thank you, Chair Mike, and the Government Operations Committee allowed me to speak today on February 28th, 2019. Again, Government Operations Committee meeting. Speaking on the 987 bill, Ms. Richardson, I spoke with her earlier, just before the meeting, and I expressed some concerns about the barriers in the working group. It's one thing to look at funding resources, but also look at the content accessibility. I know I was doing that specifically, took that elective, which was not to the cost of the district because it was elective, yet the student failed the class and had a print disability. And the school district didn't get information to them in a timely manner, which would mean adaptive or modified, which is a more acceptable level. It's my understanding that the Department of Transportation has a manual that is required to be fully accessible based on Minnesota Statute 16E03 Subdivision 9. The other piece of this is as we get into text complexity and how difficult for not just people with print disabilities, perhaps minorities, English as a second language, and economic disadvantage because they're not only they're poor, but they haven't exposed themselves to the printed word, so they have word recognition and a poor way to understand the printed word, and they haven't effectively acquired the printed word yet. Yet when they take the elective, for one of their outcomes for employment is they have appropriate transportation and they're doing it independently. It's my suggestion that this working group looks at this piece. They should also embed under identifying barriers for course participation, because course participation is about the specific curriculum, I would believe, not just because of the funding resource, but about the accessibility piece of it. And perhaps, I don't know if anyone would entertain an oral motion through the chair, or Ms. Richardson, or both, to place somewhere online 324, which identifies barriers, that we include 508, or web content accessibility guidelines, or the statute 16E.03, because I think this is a relevant piece when we look at the whole picture, not just the people being economically disadvantaged, which is in Minnesota statute 120B15, where you also find TWAGS exceptional. I think it's a relevant piece to when you get a report back to the legislature, that you will get a better handle on not just the funding piece, but how those students access the printed word. For currently in special education forms that they just redid, order on from the Minnesota legislature does not have a checkbox to consider people that have print disabilities, as well as if a checkbox for people that consider twice exceptional. So parents will not know it, and I think it would be appropriate as we move ahead for parents to understand these complex forms in a certain way that it's a medical doctor that prescribes a print disability, and currently we do not have a definition for twice exceptional in the Minnesota statute 120B15, and I'd ask you for support to sign on the bill 1370. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller. Yeah, we do have a 24-hour amendment for rules, but this bill does have another stop, so if that's an issue Representative Richardson would like to address, I know that it's something she could bring before the Ways and Means Committee as well. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Richardson.
just get my head around this a little bit. The question I had is, so we're looking at providing money to the school districts so they can subsidize low-income students being able to get into driver's education. I know a lot of school districts have, in the past, have stopped this. I think there are very few that even offer anymore, but for liability reasons. So there are so a lot of these courses, I know my three sons had to go through, we had to pay for it through a private company. So you'd be looking at money going to the school district, and that would be going to the students to help pay that tuition to those private schools. Is that how I'm reading this bill?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, you're reading it correctly. Back in the 70s, it was part of the curriculum, right? And so you just took it on site at school, and 95% of students participated at school. Today, the opportunities to participate at schools is limited to about 15% of students because most schools no longer offer this. But there are offerings that through private organizations like your son attended. And then some school districts also have like community education programs where the several districts will get together and they'll be a community ed provider.
Okay. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward too. And this is an issue that's really critical for the students in my district. And kind of to the point that Rosa Nelson made, when I was still in high school, I remember having a driver's education course that was inside of my high school, and just recently going back, it's no longer there. And so how could we make this more accessible to our students in our district would be great. And, just more to the driver's education working group, Representative Richardson, going forward, I hope you would consider adding something so that we could get the perspective of our students, too. Right now we have, in your bill, members from the public and private driver's education program and of higher education institution. And I believe that, for us to really understand some of the barriers that our students face, if we could get a student perspective on that, will be something that would be great too. Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Agreed. Thank you.
We do, I hadn't exactly closed. We seem to be moving into general member questions. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Heller, for coming up.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak as well. And the first committee said the very same thing. Just move it along, and we'll see what happens. So thank you again for this opportunity to consider an oral amendment.
Okay. Is there, Mr. Gehring, did you have a response to Representative Lee's question? Or comment or additional clarification?
Not a specific response to that question, but just to observe that the structure of this language maybe could, in a future stop, be amended to clarify some things like whether the group would require public testimony and open meetings requirements or kind of some of those details that are sort of become OPSI, like structural details that might help provide some clarity to the Representative Lee's questions and some others.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Yes, and Representative Richardson, that would be a good thing to keep in mind moving forward. Are there additional member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Richardson?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 987 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Okay. Representative Claflin. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Thank you for the treats as well. Representative Claflin, thank you for your patience here. So I will move that House File 1017 be recommended to pass and referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I understand you have an author's amendment as well. Would you like me to move that amendment now?
Yes, please.
Okay, I will move the 0073 amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay. All right, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No? Okay. The bill is in the shape you would like it. Representative Claflin, please introduce your bill.
Thank you. In earlier testimony, you heard about elementary and high school algebra teachers, and I guess you get to hear about my fifth grade teacher as well. I did a research project on women's suffrage, and at the time, I didn't realize the connection that Minnesota had to that movement and that South St. Paul, the town that I was growing up in, had to that movement.
This year, we have the opportunity to celebrate the work that that movement accomplished. On September 8th of 2019 will be the 100th anniversary of Minnesota ratifying the amendment, and the following year, August of 2020, will be the 100th anniversary of when the United States passed the 19th Amendment. We have this opportunity to connect all of us to our history and celebrate the expansion of voting rights, continue the discussion of voting and civic engagement into the present. And I am very excited to learn about some of the programs that are planned for this celebration and what I can bring back to my community, where we still have people with the same last names as the first women to cast their votes after the ratification of the 19th Amendment. I would never have guessed that South St. Paul would have those first women to cast those votes. With me today, I have Michelle Witte from the League of Women Voters, and she's going to offer some testimony for the bill as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Claflin. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Freiberg and Representative Claflin and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Witte. I'm the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters for the state of Minnesota, and we're delighted to be here this morning in favor of Bill 1017 and as amended to support the 100th anniversary, as Representative Claflin said, of women's suffrage here in Minnesota. Also, we have Jill Zonisser from the 2020 Initiative, Vote Initiative from the federal level, looking at how to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, as well as David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society, if you have any questions about the bill. I especially like being here in front of government ops because things changed a lot for government operations here in Minnesota on September 8th of 1919, when indeed a special session was held here. I actually have the state register here from that wonderful day on September 8th of 1919. When we had at 12 noon in the state capitol, the Senate voted 60 ayes to 5 nays in the House of Representatives with 120 ayes to 6 nays. One suffragist reported the moment the Senate voted, the vote was pulled, the corridors, floors, and galleries of houses were in an uproar. Hundreds of women cheered and laughed and waved the suffrage colors. While in the rotunda, a band swung into the strains of the battle hymn of the Republic. And newspaper reports from that day talk about how both political parties to Clara Euland, Minnesota's lead suffragist, and her volunteer team out to lunch at the St. Paul Hotel to celebrate. So we'd really love to relive that exciting day that changed lives for all Minnesotans here by supporting a special event here on September 8th of 2019 with a special ceremony in the Capitol Rotunda that we hope all legislators from both sides of the aisle would participate in. We'll also be hosting a day of free family fun and learning about the suffrage memorial on the garden. If you don't know, one of the largest memorials on our Capitol lawn is in honor of the 25 women who led the way for all of us to be here today. And also to boast, as Representative Claflin said, of our Minnesota state being the first woman voter. She actually voted on a water bill, a special water bill that day, which is, you know, what democracy is all about. So that's a very exciting piece, and we really want to get ahead of and the whole national celebration. In addition to that event, the League of Women Voters, as well as we will be touring an exhibit around the state through our volunteers, and the Minnesota History Center will also be hosting a major exhibit. But we really are hoping for the appropriations in this bill to allow us to have more accessibility to all state residents through a statewide calendar of events and educational resources and toolkits to help all communities celebrate this great day and how powerful voting rights for all citizens still are today. But perhaps most compelling to me is the opportunity for our esteemed legislative body to underscore the importance of continuing to promote full access to and participation in our democracy, as seen through the 72-year struggle of women winning the right to vote and to be seated alongside men, as we all are here today. The struggle, as we know, for all people of color to secure voting rights continued up through the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and it actually continues to unfold today. So we feel this would be a powerful tribute to women, but to us all, as we celebrate the centennial of women's right to vote through a statewide day of commemoration, and additional outreach that will support state residents' ability to be more fully aware of our history and its nuances, and more fully involved with our democracy today. So thank you so much for your consideration, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Woody. Do you want to speak as well on this?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any specific...
Please speak into the mic and actually just state your name for the record. And
my name is Jill Zahnizer. I represent a national coalition called the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, which is a coalition of women's history organizations and also the Smithsonian and the National Archives. I don't have separate testimony, but we'd be happy to answer any questions about the work undergoing in Minnesota to commemorate 2020 and also the national work.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, Mr. Heller, welcome back. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. You're welcome to have a chair, too.
My name is Rick Heller, unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional People with Print Disabilities. Through the chair, a specific question, as we delegate out dollars from the legislature, and they provide these tools to for the welfare of the public to be engaged about this suffrage piece on the 1017 bill. The question would yield to the chair, to the people that are creating these tools and information online. Will they assure that these tools meet the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines and 508, and actually perhaps manually check their PDFs, plural document formats, just as a user experience to see if they are compliant?
Thank you for the question. If these guidelines are in statute, I'm sure they will be. I'm sure they will be followed, Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Chair. It's my understanding nonprofits are exempt from this, and only if the question goes to the chair will you find that answer out. I'm not here for a therapy session. I think it's for the public to know that when we use state dollars, that we're looking for the majority of the welfare of the people in Minnesota that can effectively acquire the pen word digitally. Again, I request that to the chair if these individuals are willing to answer the question.
Any comment? I'm sorry, I was double-checking. Okay, Representative Claflin.
Thank you. The funds would go through the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm not sure if they have contract language that requires web accessibility, but I would certainly advocate for a full accessibility of documents.
Okay, thank you, Representative Claflin. Okay. Representative Lilly? Okay. Mr. Heller.
Just for the public to know specifically, when they have a contract and they don't know what's in the contract, I think it's relevant for them to actually look at the contract, because if it's a contract with a historical site as part of the library process, that if they don't manually check their documents, and I can't find very, very few that are fully accessible, and right now that's coming out of that library. So thank you for the opportunity to speak. Hopefully somebody in the public will address this, analyze and evaluate it, and perhaps get on board on how everybody can acquire the printed word effectively in a digital format. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on House File 1017? Okay, seeing none, is there any member questions or comments? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Claflin. I'm just really concerned that we've gone from 10,000 to 200,000 and that we're actually naming the League of Women Voters. I know that there's other groups in my area in St. Cloud that probably would want to be able to take advantage of some grants as well in addition to the League. So I guess I'm just concerned that we're naming the League, making it sound like nobody else is welcome to participate. It is a lot of extra money, and I just want to make sure that everybody that wants to celebrate gets an opportunity to do so. So could you just fill us in on why the change?
Representative Claflin.
Certainly. First, I will address the change in the money requested. The original bill had asked to create a commission to work on planning this event, and it was a rather large commission, and that $10,000 was actually to run the commission, which could then help other organizations apply for grants. Since that did not actually get passed last year, and we now have a shorter timeline for a September celebration, we thought that it was wiser to dismiss with the commission and go right to the Historical Society to help get that program moving. And thought that about $200,000 would be enough to make a statewide effort to really celebrate everywhere in Minnesota. I can let Michelle Witte talk more about the League of Women Voters involvement.
Yeah. Ms. Witte.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great question. That money actually, as we have costed out, we're working in partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society. It will not go directly, all of it does not go directly to us, although we do have 35, you know, leagues across the state, including St. Cloud and other cities. So we were looking for ways that we could partner to be able to provide especially that technical assistance across the state. So the money definitely, the idea, original intent really was with this commission to have pass-through grants, and that timing has gone by, but the idea is to work through the Minnesota Historical Society on even having a task force together. That's part of the language, I believe, to have a task force to make sure that the money is equitably distributed to organizations of interest. Absolutely.
Yeah, and since this is coming from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, I assume this will also need to make a stop in the Legacy Committee when we have the chair here. So, Representative Tice, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm just concerned about that part of it, you know, that there are going to be groups that just feel like they're not included because only one is named. It's just my concern.
Any additional member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, Representative Bonner.
Sorry, I'm here in the corner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Claflin, I want to say thank you for this. I really appreciate this. It's been about 233 years, by my calculations, since the U.S. Constitution was passed, and it was about 133 years that it took to finally get the right to vote for women. So as a former member of the Women's March and a firm believer in women's right to have control over their own destiny, I applaud you for bringing this forward. I did have a couple of clerical questions. I noticed, you know, in the membership again, and this is just an odd one, but maybe this you can clarify why this is. I noticed on line 2.16, we have a representative from Xi Phi Beta Society. Could you clarify what that organization does and who they are?
Representative Claflin?
Yes. Thank you. That commission that included all of those diverse members would not be the same as the task force that or the community advisory committee created in this bill. I think my other testifiers can speak to that particular organization.
Okay. Ms. Zonheiser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Zeta Phi Beta is a traditionally black sorority, and they've become involved with the 2020 initiative at the national level because they have a centennial also of their organization in 2020. And we reached out to members in the state, and they were also very interested in becoming engaged in suffrage. When we started, when we had a bill last year, they were one of the groups that we worked with to come forward, in addition to the League, my own group, and the women's the Minnesota Women's Consortium. So we think it's important in terms of the commemoration of the 2020 centennial to make the point that the 19th Amendment, unfortunately, wasn't enforced, particularly in the South, and so it was not the event for black women in the United States that it was for white women because they continued to struggle. So we think that the sorority is an important partner in terms of moving forward.
Representative Bonner?
Thank you. And I just want to say, first of all, I thank you because this is a pretty good comprehensive list. Sorry, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate all of that. And certainly, as one of the organizers from the Women's March, I understand trying to get one of these types of events off the ground is a big endeavor. But just to kind of back up Representative Tice for a brief moment, is there any possibility of considering something to account for if there are any other groups across the state that would really like to participate or any opportunities for them to participate?
Representative Claflin?
Thank you. First, I'd like to clarify that the amendment does away with that commission. The amendment is to create the day of recognition and the funding, and the original bill creating the commission has been deleted from the bill. And Michelle Witte can speak a bit more to the groups.
Yeah, and I think we
Ms.
just...
Ms. Witte.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you so much. Absolutely, we are all in agreement that the goal is, and we actually, as part of the commission, originally with the commission and the groups, there was a $500,000 appropriation last year at that time to be able to do pass-through grants because we couldn't, there was no legacy bill, it didn't proceed. So we did scale back that appropriation, but we are absolutely committed, and the bill, I think in the amended version here, I brought in, where is the amended version? Where it says to provide financial assistance to local civic and historical organizations for which the Minnesota Historical Society may provide grant administration services. So we also say that we would create a community advisory committee to ensure that diverse voices from across the state will guide activities under this section. We already have a very large group of people, including the Minnesota Women's Consortium and other groups that are working with us on the September 9th event. That is our goal. The sole goal here is to create really a transparent and wonderful celebration where all voices can be heard and be accessible across the state of Minnesota. So we can certainly add some clarifying language if that would help people.
Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Claflin and ladies, I thank you for that, and I want to apologize to you. I just realized I missed the backside of the page where it took that piece out, so my apologies to you for that. And really just to conclude, thank you again for bringing this forward. I really hope that it's a successful celebration, and I certainly look forward to it.
Okay. Is there any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Claflin.
Thank you very much for hearing this bill today and continuing the discussion of voting rights and civil engagement for all Minnesotans.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1017, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Claflin. I just want to draw your attention to a bill referral memo that's in your packet. And with that, there's seeing no additional discussion or bills, we are adjourned.